Well, good morning. It's Thursday at 11 a.m. WFVR-LP in South Royalton. This is Green Zine. Stay with us. A couple of interesting guests coming up. We're headed to West Virginia and Kentucky up to the mountaintop with Gangsta Grass.
Tall city sticker with a lie to sell. Coming up in here where I dwell. Now I'm living in a bombed out shell. Took my heaven and they built a hell.
Taking picture is a song that remains unsung.
Ruination day at hand. Poison water in a backroom pen. Bought and sold my native land. There once was a mountain where I stand.
Taking picture is a song that remains unsung.
You don't know my face. You don't know my name. I talk different than you and I don't look the same. I speak in circles to back up my claim. I will rob you, blind, rape, pillage, and maim. Yo, I'm so connected and it goes so far. Pollution so bad, it'll rot your car. Not to mention your brain and lungs, till your future is a song that remains unsung.
Hey, hey, if I need a lay, a luscious green is now dead and gray. These hills for an empty sky.
Particulates, mercury, lead, arsenic. Your whole family sick, miners buried in a ditch. Coal sludge spill from Hollow Valley fill. Toxic byproducts making you ill. There's a coal burning plant on the horizon. Life expectancy falls and profits rising. Money pays legislators, they do us favors. Now you got a brain tumor, so do five of your neighbors.
Green is now dead and gray. I found, didn't I? Trade these hills for an empty sky. Let the picket lines get blurred. Let the prophet's soul get slurred. The man and bribe the press, all in the name of progress. You double talk, I second guess. You get more and I get less.
Bust your union to crush your will. Take all of the jobs as we go in for the kill. Blast the mountain where there would be your windmill. Blow it all to smithereens till there's just rubble on a hill. Loud sound defects, mad birth defects. Jobs you never see, we use as a pretext. When it rains, it'll flood. Bury your home in mud. Ain't no love carcinogens in your blood.
Hey, hey, if I need a lay, a luscious green is now dead and gray. I didn't I trade these hills for an empty sky.
Grassroots movement just might shut us down. We gotta stop them before they run us out of town. Listen to the chant, see the people, hear the sound. Guess like a windmill, what goes around comes around.
Hey, hey, if I need a lay, a luscious green is now dead and gray.
Reading about coal, hearing about coal, mountaintop mining, etc. That was Mountaintop from Gangsta Grass, joined by Tomasia and Brandy Hart here on Green Zine. Todd with you. Henry just about to join us on our weekly environmental show. Green Zine is brought to you today by Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. And now, streaming in or phoning in from Burlington, I believe. Good morning, Henry. Henry, are you there? Hello? Well, that's a bit odd. I wonder if Henry got cut off. I'm going to leave that up for now, and I'm going to hang up on Henry in case he needs to call back. He might be having trouble getting a hold of... I think he's going to call me once he gets a hold of our guest. All right, we are on Green Zine, and I'm going to go to some local news right off the bat. Here we go. Now I'm going to put him back in the system. Are you there, Henry?
I am.
Okay, yeah, we didn't have you there initially, but we got you now.
Yeah. So I was trying to get Emily. She's tied up on another call, so we'll get to her when we're ready for her.
Okay, yeah, she's a busy lady, but we should give folks a heads up that Emily Ruff of the Sage Mountain Botanical Conservation Area, that last part might not be quite accurate, but it's a great place in Vermont, and she is going to be speaking at the Tunbridge Public Library, courtesy of the Tunbridge Conservation Commission, a week from tomorrow. They've been doing a Friday night series, so that will be on the 7th of March, 7 p.m., Tunbridge Public Library. But we've got a whole lot of other things while we wait to connect with Emily. How are you doing, Henry?
I am good. And we should maybe also say, I don't know what you said in my absence, that we have a second guest as well, Paul Bierman from University of Vermont, who has written a quite marvelous book on his work with the glaciers. He got a hold of some samples through a convoluted process that took years of messing with, and he evaluated stuff that was going on at the very bottom of the Greenland ice sheet and in the soil, and found that that has once been a warm zone. And so his book is When the Ice is Gone, and what an ice core reveals about the Earth's tumultuous history and perilous future. So we will get into implications of that and why is that happening and what's going to happen again, and you know. All right, so that'll be in the after the halfway part in the show, we'll get into that.
Yeah, and as far as what was going on while you were trying to track down Emily, I was playing a song that had a lot going on as far as pollution, people having to move due to mountaintop coal mining, which we know up until recently, I don't think it's quite stopped now, but down in West Virginia and particularly in Kentucky, blowing up mountains where people used to live, but they either had to move or were bought out. And then, of course, a lot of the byproducts of extracting that strip mining coal get into the water system. Flooding becomes a lot more likely in those areas. And I was reading an article yesterday about a lot of folks that used to live in the river valleys. There were some very serious flooding in the last couple of years, particularly in Kentucky, but also in West Virginia. They are now being offered a chance to live on the flat plateaus that got blown up in the mountains. Now, you can imagine there's some really good soil up there for growing plants and trees. It is something to sort of, it's a wry smile indeed. But some of those folks don't really have anywhere else to go. They're being subsidized as far as, and they do, a lot of them want to stay in West Virginia, even though what they grew up with looks a whole lot different now. So I thought I would play that song from Gangsta Grass. And then if you had a chance to listen to the beginning of Radio EcoShock, he was talking with an expert who follows the international coal industry. I believe she was speaking from Germany and mentioning that the European Union in general is not going back to coal. There are a lot of changes happening, some moves away from renewable energy. This country is, you know, certainly with a new administration, dig baby dig as well as drill baby drill. Coal is certainly coming back. In states like Wyoming and Montana has a big coal reserve as well. So just when we thought, you know, we could get coal out the door and maybe get nuclear out the door, they're still lurking, Henry.
Yes. Well, so we mentioned many years ago when we, early days of Greenzine, a testimonial that I had heard or saw as a video about the West Virginia coal mining, and a person had gone up in a private plane and was flying over that area, and they said there was nothing but devastation as far as he could see from the airplane.
Wow.
This was a clear day.
Yeah.
And what happens when you take that those mountaintops off is all the soil has been piled somewhere else, or basically is not spread out over the land anymore. And so there's no sponge to hold the water when it rains, and that's why you're getting the flood. And they did experiments with going onto that reclaimed coal fields and putting animals on it and doing controlled grazing, where you're and they were building topsoil at a rate of about an inch a year.
Whoa.
By doing that. So there is those grass-eating animals have the ability to rebuild the soil.
Well, so quick question on that. So possibly toxic topsoil, or at least what was underneath, have they done tests on the animals and on the soil to show that it's healthy topsoil?
Haven't got into that one.
Okay,
but I would
next
say
time.
That the topsoil probably is healthy.
Okay.
And I imagine the runoff is where the majority of the toxic material is, but that's just shooting from the hip.
Yeah.
I haven't studied that.
Well, that's okay to shoot from the hip, Henry. Good.
That'd be my opinion.
You've been known to do that before. All right. So
can
I don't
get into a bird note?
Yeah, we could do bird note. Do you want to try? Is Emily going to try you, or are you going to try her?
I'm going to try her.
But this line should stay open? Yep.
Yes.
I keep the line open. All right. Here comes Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
Quick message on Bird Note. I chose this one because it's all driving the ecological system of making soil. Think about it from that perspective when you listen to it.
All right, good advice. Here we go. Birds, berries, and germination.
This is Bird Note. When birds swallow berries, they also ingest the seeds within the pulp. After just half an hour or so, they dispose of the seed by passing it through their digestive system, or regurgitating it. Either way, the hard seeds wind up on the ground. There's an evolutionary reason for this. Plants that evolved fruits with edible flesh could attract birds to eat them. Then the birds transport the hard seeds within the soft fruits to new spots for them to take root. But birds do more than just carry the seeds. Their digestive system, including their muscular gizzard, grinds away the hard outer coating on seeds, making them more likely to germinate once the birds deposit them. What's more, seeds in a bird's droppings are prepackaged in nutrient-rich fertilizer when they hit the soil. Birds disperse seeds for more than 300 trees, bushes, and vines in North America. The benefits are mutual. A fruit-eating bird sows more fruit-bearing plants, leading to more fruit for birds to reap in the future. It's a relationship developed over millennia of coevolution. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thank you, Michael. And let's see if Henry, are you there?
I am.
And it sounds like another voice on there.
Emily Ruff, welcome to Green Scene.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, Emily. Hey, it's great to connect. Thanks for responding so quickly when I sent you an email. My partner, Betsy, is part of the Tunbridge Conservation Commission, and we're so pleased that you're going to be able to give a presentation a week from tomorrow.
I'm so excited to join you all. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I see from your website that you have quite a far-ranging group of things. Tell us about Sage Mountain Botanical Sanctuary.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Many of your listeners may be familiar with Sage Mountain from its founder, herbalist Rosemary Gladstar, who established our conservation center back in 1987. She lived and taught from our 600-acre wilderness preserve for about 30 years, and back in 2018 we founded a nonprofit organization to carry forth her work and legacy here. We're in Orange, Vermont, just south of Grattan State Forest, and the core tenets of our work are conservation, education, and healing, so really looking to how can we as humans coexist in greater harmony with our non-human community, plants, animals, and otherwise, and through that build bridges to healing for ourselves and our communities and the greater world.
How many people do you think visit you in one way or another over the course of a year? Are you a hidden secret or what?
I think it's a mix of both. I think a lot of folks, especially in the local area, are always like, oh, I had no idea that was up there. And then some folks travel from far and wide, and it's a bit of a legend for folks, especially folks who have studied herbalism and been a part of Rosemary's courses or books over the years. We probably have a few hundred visitors every year. There's been thousands of students since 1987 that have come from all over New England and really all parts of the world to visit Sage Mountain. I started coming here as a student myself about 25 years ago, and prior to living in Vermont, I was a resident of Florida, so traversed what felt like quite a way at the time when I was in my early 20s to come study with Rosemary. So certainly has a long list of visitors, but this era of our work, we have a couple of core programs. We don't run herbalism trainings in the same way that Rosemary did, in part because a lot of seeds were planted in the 30 years of her work, and there's some amazing herbal schools in the area now. So we really tried to focus on providing opportunities that weren't so prevalent in the area. And one of our flagship programs is a youth program called After School in Nature. And in the summertime, it's counterpart summer camp in nature. And we serve youth in grades 3 through 8, primarily from low-income families in Orange and Washington counties. So every single day through the year, we have kiddos running around through the meadows and hiking, or this time of year, snowshoeing on the trails and learning about the natural communities around them. And then in the warmer months of the year, June through October, we do offer weekend classes and day visits, volunteer and garden opportunities, and we also do private retreats. So if folks are looking to have a quiet spot to work on their book or creative project, or they want to find a place in nature to get away from the city with their family, we offer opportunities for those types of excursions too. And then all year long, we do a lot of work in conservation research and advocacy. We, over the decades, have documented about 400 plant species on our property. We have a wide monitoring program of the wildlife and the birds that live here. We share a lot of that information with other nonprofits and with state agencies. And then from time to time, we collaborate with our legislators or other folks in Montpelier to try to advocate for the protection of our watersheds and our wildlife and all the plants and humans that inhabit those, too.
Does your property have, I don't know if you've looked outside of it, but when you cross over into the forested section that adjoins you, do you have about the same balance of plant, animal, you know, biodiversity as next door, or has the land been managed in a way that has increased the biodiversity on your site?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say that there are certainly some pockets of Grattan that are really offer unique ecosystems. You know, I think fens and wetlands in the last 3 or 4 years, and especially kind of thinking about the floods, I've been really doing just a lot of personal time learning about wetlands and exploring them, and I think those represent some of those rich ecosystems that have a lot of biodiversity. But our property, I think, has been really unique in that since the 1980s, Rosemary and her family and her team have really stewarded the property in a way to promote biodiversity. I think before people knew what the word biodiversity was, just really thinking about what are ways that we can, protect the endemic species that are not found in other places. And so as an example, one ecosystem that we are really proud of on the property that we think is really special and unique is our fen, and we our northern cedar forest wetland, and in the fen we have at least 3 different species of Cypripedium, the lady slipper orchids. But the showy lady slippers in particular, we have counted upwards of 3,000 of them in their bloom. And so it's one of those sort of very special ecosystems where, plant geeks like myself, some folks come from far and wide in the summertime to get a peek at just the abundance of Cypripedium. And that's, one particular species that, as the showy lady slipper, is pretty showy and so gets a lot of attention. But there's certainly some other species that we have, some S1 and S2 state-protected species that are found in other communities, I would say, in our corridor and throughout the state, certainly, but not as frequently. So I think part of that management practice for us has been, in the last 35 years, first and foremost, just getting to know the plants that grow in our area and also learning about ecosystems and how we can better manage and support, not just for the plants, but the pollinators and the wildlife and all the ways that those living beings interconnected help to really allow for those more rare and unique species to thrive.
Well, when I was reading a background about Sage Mountain and about you, that interconnectedness of species, but then how does that work as far as we've had some lady slipper walks down here, not as many as what you just cited there, but having that sort of interface between humans, I'm assuming there are trails throughout the area there, but, having people get educated, know about it, but without sort of trampling on things, without, sort of ruining what's there, I imagine that it's very sensitive, a lot of the areas there at the preserve.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We have a trail network of about 15 miles that doesn't cut through the fen and the wetlands.
Okay.
More in some of the forest ecosystems. And we have some really great mix of softwood and hardwood forest. We've worked with Audubon over the years to kind of document the bird species here. And we have hermit thrush and a lot of really cool species that are less common than in other places. So for folks that are birders, it's always really fun to kind of explore. But for something like the fen, for example, we currently are in the process of reestablishing it, but there historically was a boardwalk in one small section of the fen. And fens, for your listeners that don't know these wetland ecosystems, the soft forest floor is really spongy, but to have human or bear or moose foot traffic through it can, in certain times of years, be really damaging. And so we do have kind of one small trail on the edge of the fen that's still in kind of a dry upland edge so that folks like students can come and Native Plant Trust can come do their plant counts and things like that and walk on a path that's not trampling over that sensitive spongy soil but still get the beautiful view of those plants. And then just other areas that, the bears and moose and bobcat and fisher get to traverse as they want and will, but humans avoid those areas just so we can let those ecosystems thrive.
Would you care to conjecture what your impact is on people that come and see things there? It seems to me there's an awareness component, there's a spiritual component, there's maybe changes in behavior, human behavior that people take home with them, and think, well, I'm going to do more of this or whatever, change the way I am aware of the world. Any thoughts about that kind of holistic piece?
Well, I'll attempt to not self-congratulate too much about the work that we do here at Sage. And really, it's not us. It's just us as humans keeping access open and encouraging, inviting folks to come out into the wilderness. I think most of your listeners who are active hikers or naturalists or recreators in Vermont's beautiful wild places have had the experience of going to a state forest or a state park and feeling the shifts emotionally and mentally and physically and spiritually that take place just by moving out of the man-made environment and into the nature-made environment. And so I think there's, you know, an element of any time that people step into nature, they're changed and transformed. And I think what we perhaps is unique about Sage is that we invite our visitors to recognize a couple of things that maybe you don't always get when you go to a state forest or a local park. And I think one of those is really remembering that humans are part of nature. I think through the development of the national park system and the colonization of the United States, there became this concept of wilderness as a place in nature without man. And I think historically, if you study that, that's really inaccurate, right? Because Ansel Adams and these beautiful photos out west of these glorious landscapes in California and Oregon, those places weren't without humans. They were actually very intentionally maintained and interacted with the indigenous people that lived there, and that's what allowed for those beautiful wildflower meadows. And the minute that those indigenous communities were removed from those places, those beautiful meadows started to turn right back into forests again. And so I think we have in this culture established this concept of nature that intrinsically we get the idea that it means that humans can't be a part of it or aren't a part of it. And what we hope to kind of reframe is that actually humans are a part of nature. And granted, we've not been a very kind part of nature or a good neighbor in nature for most of the last 100, 200, 500 years. But it's not impossible for us to be a really healthy friend to and have healthy relationships with our non-human communities and be part of nature. And I think for a lot of people, just being reminded, like, we're supposed to be here. Like, this is, you know, this is important for our soul and our life, for us to be part of nature. And for nature, it's important that we're a part of it in a good way. So I think that's maybe a unique invitation that is woven through a lot of our programs at Sage. And then I think the other piece is just the animism of the non-human world. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we're trying to anthropomorphize all the animals and plants and, you know, call them Sally and Joe and Sue and, like, talk to them in human ways, but just to really learn about these beings as the living, sentient beings that they are, whether it's birds or pollinators or four-leggeds or the plant world, and just be reminded of that intelligence of nature and the possibility for us to commune with it, which is not necessarily the language that you see on the interpretive signs when you're walking through a state park. And so I think those two pieces are sort of maybe a little subversively woven through, you know, some of our programs and invitations. We're not outwardly trying to proselytize to people to hug all the trees all the time, but in the same sense, we really have seen both in our own personal experiences and the history of all the visitors at Sage Mountain, as well as a lot of psychological and scientific studies in the last 30 years, that building these relationships with nature in these emotional, psychological, and spiritual ways really benefits us as individuals, and that can benefit us as communities and as a species, and hopefully that can be a turning point for us to recognize our relationship in the wider world and be better stewards because of that.
Yeah, and I'm thinking here in Vermont, and a lot of towns, most towns, I would say, have either a conservation commission or they have town forests that are being maintained in ways that are either, you know, well, who knows how they're being maintained. But I'm thinking that some of your guests may be people that are from conservation commissions and forest committees that are coming and learning some practices there and taking them back to their individual towns. Do you ever hear back from some of the folks that have come for, you know, a class, or even I notice you offer online classes as well, who report back and say, no, we adopted this practice and, you know, we really appreciate it or it's working. Do you get that type of feedback from people that are at that level of conservation?
We absolutely have. And I think what I find the most often that is happening is that there is a subtle but profound shift happening on the individual level and on the personal level. And I think, you know, I will say that I've been admittedly kind of part of this process myself. When I was living in Florida, I did a lot of advocacy and activism in the conservation realm, and I was going to meetings and I was writing plans and I was, you know, part of these processes, and especially processes to protect places that we love, right, and that we don't want to see developed or managed in a way that feels to us as conservationists like mismanagement. But you know, after a season of doing a lot of that work, I would often feel really depleted and have less hope. And then I would remember, oh, you know, I haven't really, like, taken a good hike and had my phone turned off and just been with myself in the woods and thought about things or, you know, cleared my mind or whatever. And so I was at an event with a lot of heads of Agency of Natural Resources and Fish and Wildlife from all of the New England states as well as some provinces in Canada this summer. And at the end, we spent a weekend talking about connectivity and conservation and corridors and how can we support these bigger ecosystems and how does that trickle down to individual species. And at the end, we were all pledging what is it that we want to commit to as we leave this group event and all this work we've done together. And I felt very clear and simple in the message that, like, I want to remember every day that I'm a part of nature, and I want to be in nature and remind nature that I'm a part of it and keep that relationship alive. And it was so incredible to see my colleagues, both folks wearing suits that do all this important conservation work and also grassroots folks sitting across the table from me that were like, oh, that's a piece that I miss, and I need to be reminded of that. And I think that's what a lot of conservation commissioners and folks with agencies and organizations, when they visit SAGE, I think that's a message that we see a lot, is that, you know, we can do all this external work. We want to save these places that mean so much to us, and we also have a part of that saving that happens inside of ourselves with our relationship to nature that's just about simple practices that we can tend to every day that keep us, I think, fueled for those bigger external missions of writing a town plan or raising funds or advocating with a diverse community about different ways to manage a town forest that may be creative or unique or not how we've historically done it. You know, I think that requires some spiritual fuel to stay in some of those long marathons. And I think it's that returning to that relationship in nature that can really be a part of nourishing that.
Yeah, I can really empathize with that that image of long marathons, because some of these reforms or needed changes in the environment do take a long time. We're going to have to maybe leave it there, but really appreciate, Emily, you checking in. And once again, Emily will be speaking at the Tunbridge Public Library a week from tomorrow, February 7th, and the title of your talk, Protecting Vermont's Ecosystem, Backyard Strategies for Corridor Conservation. Emily, thanks for taking some time out of your busy day to join us here on Green Zine.
Thank you.
Inspiring.
So much.
Inspiring. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Henry, I'm going to let you go because I know you got to make another phone call, and I'll look for the little flasher coming up here in just a moment. You're tuned to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. I'm going to hit that button. There's a lot of buttons that we have to push around here. Yeah, let's make sure that's off. I'm going to take that down as well. Todd with you here. We've got about 26 minutes left in the show. And while Henry's hooking up with the Gund Institute's Paul Bierman, I wanted to let you know about what's happening out there in the woods. This is courtesy of Northern Woodlands Magazine, a quarterly that's published, I believe, in Lyme, New Hampshire, February 1st, right around the corner. In fact, it's on Saturday, and I think this is probably written by Elise Tillinghast. This Week in the Woods observed a large flock of American robins, really, in late January, early February, feeding on a crabapple tree and perhaps getting drunk. Drunk robins, another thing to worry about, because sugars and fruit can ferment over the course of years. Robins and other frugivorous, never seen that word, birds such as starlings and waxwings can become intoxicated from their winter diets. Also in the bird world, yeah, of course, wild turkeys have both distinguished progeny and distinguished forebears. The much heavier domestic turkey was, of course, bred from wild turkeys, and genomic research shows that the wild turkey is genetically closer to its dinosaur ancestors. One more little tidbit here, a couple actually having to do with plants. Red bark phenomenon is a crusty or filmy condition caused by green algae containing orange-red pigments and affecting numerous tree species. I've seen that stuff. Only detected in New England within the past 20 years, it has so far shown no known threats to tree or forest health. The Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station notes that trends linked to climate change may have contributed to the increased prevalence of RBP. So the next time you're, you know, at a cocktail party and someone says, "What's up with RBP?" you'll know they're talking about red bark phenomenon. And finally, boreal oak moss is a lichen, not a moss, and lives on numerous trees other than oaks and may even prefer conifers. The common shrubby or fruticose lichen often grows on the very ends of branches, a situation conducive both in dispersing its ceridia, the clusters of algal cells wrapped in fungal filaments used for asexual vegetative reproduction, and the specimens like this one breaking off and falling to the forest floor. There's a picture here if you go to the Northern Woodlands website. It's best to avoid handling boreal oak moss as the usnic acid. Boy, there are six words in this article that I've never heard before, but I guess I'll have to include them in future vocabulary. That acid, that usnic, U-S-N-I-C acid, may irritate your skin. All right, the phone is not lighting up yet, so Henry is still working on getting a hold of our guest, and there he is, right on schedule. So let's do that, and say, welcome back. Oop. Are you there, Henry? Hello?
Yeah.
Hello.
Oh, here we go. We're all
Hi
set.
Hi there. We're back together.
We are.
Paul Bierman, welcome to GreenZine. I have been working my way through your book for several hours this morning, and it really is a lovely book that is extremely readable. And I'm interested in the technical outcome and how it relates to our world going forward. The name of the book, just for I've given it to people earlier, but When the Ice Is Gone, What an Ice Core Reveals About Earth's Troublesome History and Perilous Future. So welcome to GreenZine, and let's jump in at whatever level you want. Maybe we ought to do a really quick kind of grand overview, because the history and the personalities of the people involved in the history of ice cores and learning what we can from ice cores and from cores of soil below the ice, even more important, is quite a tale.
Okay, well, thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah,
good frosty day to talk about ice.
Yes, we have. I think there must be a lot of cracking and groaning out on Lake Champlain last night.
I don't know. When I drove past it this morning, most of it's still open water.
Oh, okay.
Really? Well,
that has to do with our warming climate.
Yeah. So if we go, let's start maybe by a quick overview of kind of your piece in figuring out that Greenland was once a warm zone with plants growing and not being encased in ice permanently the way it feels it is now.
Sure. So I'm a geologist by training, and I got interested in Greenland almost 20 years ago, and got to take 4 trips up there where we did not spend much time on the ice. We spent a lot of time around the edge of the ice trying to figure out when that ice had gotten bigger and when it had gotten smaller in the past. I'd always had an interest in ice cores, which are the drillings through the ice sheet, two of which in Greenland reach the bottom, because they hold a history of Earth's climate in Greenland going back over 120,000 years. So they take us through the warm time now that humans have evolved societies, and they take us back to the last cold time when ice covered New England and much of the Northern Hemisphere, and they take us back even into the warm time before that. You know, these are the natural cycles of climate between warm and cold that happen on thousands to tens of thousands of year timescales. And I knew that one of those cores, a core at a place called Camp Century, the first core that was ever drilled through the ice sheet, I knew that that core had gotten to the bottom. But when I asked around, people said, that material from below the ice, the frozen soil, is gone. We don't have that anymore. We just have the ice. And because I'm a geologist, I tend to focus on frozen or on soil and dirt and gravel and sand and not on ice. And in 2019, I got an email from a colleague in Denmark asking me if I was interested in looking at materials from the bottom of ice cores. And I said, sure, and got on a plane and flew to Denmark with about 2 weeks' notice and with about half a dozen other geoscientists. And they had found these missing materials. They were in a Copenhagen freezer, probably somewhere in the back corner, and when they moved to a brand new place to keep all their miles and miles of ice cores, they found them. And they invited a group of us to come and look at them and to think about what to do. And so I was really privileged to be given 2 pieces for our laboratory. It took several months to get them here. And we started taking them apart. They were from the bottom and the top of the frozen soil core that, just to put it in context, was recovered underneath nearly a mile of ice. And it's about 11 feet long. And so we got about the size of a baseball amount of material from each of these 2 samples. And we had about 10 people on the team we were working with. And those pieces came to Vermont. We were the sort of lead lab on this. And we started taking them apart. We took them apart by melting and then by putting them through sieves that look like window screens that keep the bugs out, but different size window screens. And that first day when we were doing this, we looked at the bucket of water that we were saving. We saved everything because we had so little. And floating on the top of one of the bins, buckets of water, was little black bits that reminded me of fossils I'd once found in lake sediments from Vermont. We popped them under a microscope, and there were twigs and leaves and seeds and bits of insects.
Wow.
Which was absolutely unexpected because this came from beneath nearly a mile of ice. And that day, I have to say, it changed my scientific life. Because now we knew that there was a time when the ice was gone on Greenland. And instead of ice, there was a tundra landscape full of all the plants you'd expect to find in the Arctic tundra today, and the little midges that swarm around your head and all that. And they were nearly perfectly preserved, frozen underneath the ice, and they'd been kept frozen. We didn't know how long at that point. The work we've done since tells us that those bits of twigs and leaves and moss and bugs are about 400,000 years old.
Wow.
Which is really interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but just put that 400,000 years in perspective for people. Where does that place us in terms of human activity and in terms of glaciations and
sure.
So forth?
So over about the last 1 million years, the glaciers have come and gone on a cycle of about 100,000 years. And all this is, you know, it's easy for geologists to talk about. And for the average citizen of Vermont, it's pretty obscure, right? We think a year, 2 years, 4 years. We don't think 100,000 years, right? So it's way back in time. But the real interest in this time 400,000 years ago is we've known that that was a time when Earth's climate was warm in the past. There's lots of indications that at least parts of the Greenland ice sheet had melted, parts of Antarctica had melted, sea level was much higher than it is today, at least 20 feet higher than it is today. So, you know, you can imagine your favorite beach that maybe you've been to in New Hampshire or Massachusetts, wherever. And now imagine that beach with 20 feet more water, because that's what it looked like 400,000 years ago. And so the analog here, to cut right to the chase, is that happened when carbon dioxide levels were far lower than they are today. That happened when carbon dioxide levels were very similar to what they were before the Industrial Revolution and before we started burning coal, gas, oil, cutting down forests extensively. So I take this as a warning that in the past, the ice sheet has melted naturally. And now we are at a position far warmer, far more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than when some of that melt happened before. So we're basically taking that ice sheet and poking at it. And a lot of people will say, well, you know, why does that matter, right? We're sitting here in Vermont. Do we really care if the Greenland ice sheet melts? And there's two reasons we care. One I already alluded to, which if you have a beach you like, imagine that beach with 20 feet, 25 feet more water, because that's what will happen if the ice sheet melts. But the other is that the ice sheet actually acts as a giant reflector. It's bright white, and that sunlight that comes in the summer in Greenland, most of it gets reflected back. And I think we've all experienced that, right? If you get in a white car versus a black car in the middle of the summer. And so by removing that ice sheet and replacing it with the dark land surface, we're going to heat up the planet. So it actually, what happens in Greenland doesn't stay in Greenland, and it matters to Vermont's future.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have to think, 100,000 or 400,000 years for that. And it sounds like if we were to continue on our current path, that time difference between, you know, melting and then reforming of the ice sheet is going to be a lot shorter this time around. It already
and
is.
That's really insightful. Yeah. That's really insightful, because what we are doing is exactly what nature does, but we're doing it on a time scale that's unprecedented. There's nothing like this. Nature doesn't warm up the climate this quickly. And so there's really no way for organisms to adapt. I'm not even sure how well as humans we're going to adapt to this as the seas flood and the Phoenix has, you know, 100 days over 100 degrees at some point. So it's the rapidity of change that is so striking. But the other piece I want to throw into this that I think runs against the common perception, right? The common perception is that, you know, climate and climate concerns and words like the climate crisis come from the left or come from blue states. And I think what's really interesting, and hopefully interesting for your listeners, is that the interest in drilling these ice cores and understanding the climate of Greenland came from the U.S. military. It didn't come from a political faction. It came from one of the most conservative organizations, you know, in the country, which is the U.S. Army and the U.S. Air Force. And they were worried about changing climate, and they were worried about a Soviet invasion over the poles. And so they militarized Greenland, and they spent inordinate amounts of money on research about snow and ice and glaciers, of which this first core was the sort of premier. They were the first to ever drill through an ice sheet. It was the first core to tell us about the history of climate. They really wanted to know, because for the military, understanding the environment in which you work is managing threats and preparing for the future. Again, completely different than the political climate we find ourselves in now. It was a concern about how they're going to operate in a future potentially warmer world, and that's in the 1950s and 1960s.
My understanding is the military is one of the only operations that tries to do 50-year-long planning. Corporations are on a shorter scale, and politicians are on a 2-year election cycle.
You're right. There is one other organization, and it's called the Reinsurance. Because they insure the insurers. And so they hire climate scientists to do this. And I think this is really important to talk about, as we're at such a moment of national division in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that we shouldn't be divided over something like climate, which equally affects all of us. However we voted, whatever our political preferences are, we're affected by the climate in which we live. And I think if we can start moving the conversation away from the political side to the reality, as you say, the military and these longer planning timelines, the better off we're going to be as a society as a whole, and the better off we're going to be as people inside that society.
Yeah. Well, so we go back to the mechanics. I get knowing that the Greenland ice sheet was not always there. One of the questions that comes to me that I suspect we don't really know the answer to it, but how with the CO2 level in the atmosphere being down at pre-industrial levels for us now, how come we had warm conditions in Greenland?
So much of that depends on how the Earth is orbiting the sun and the tilt of the Earth over time, which we know very well and we know how it changes. And that drives, thought to drive these natural ice ages and warming periods. And I think what's important to remember is under the natural conditions, the ice left, but it also came back.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's a lot harder to get ice back on than it is to melt it off. And that comes from the fact that, and we all know this, if we climb up Mount Mansfield or Camel's Hump or Ascutney, wherever you happen to be and are climbing, as you get higher in the atmosphere, it gets colder. And so you have to throw on a sweater or a jacket as you go hiking, even in the summer sometimes. The same thing happens in the Greenland ice sheet. So as the ice sheet melts and gets lower, it's almost 2 miles high. It's a very big ice sheet, so it's way up in the atmosphere and it's way cold at the peak. As that starts to melt, it actually encounters warmer and warmer and warmer air. So it's this cycle of doom, basically. Once you start to melt the ice sheet and it gets to a lower elevation, then it melts more, and it gets to even lower elevation, it melts more. And the flip side of that is if you want to rebuild it, you have to get the temperature close to sea level cold so you can start having that snow that fell one winter last through the summer and into the next. And then more snow can accumulate, and that's how you build an ice sheet. So it's a tricky thing to rebuild an ice sheet, and it's why it is so important for us right now to think about how to lower the rate of rise of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere and eventually how to get it out of the atmosphere. We have a little bit of time. I don't view myself as a doomsayer who's screaming that the sky will quite fall in tomorrow. We have years to maybe a decade or two, but the sooner we start to pull back on the carbon dioxide and the sooner we start to get it out of the atmosphere, the cheaper it's going to be. It's going to cost us a pile of money to get this carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So from a purely financial point of view, we are way better off now to reduce our emissions than to try to clean it up later.
Cheaper not to admit it than it is to pull it back down again.
Absolutely. And right now it is cheaper to generate power with solar and wind than it is with many of the fossil fuels. And that's, I think, no matter who's in the White House, that in the end is what's going to turn things around, is that it's economics have driven coal out, not political woke ideology to get rid of coal, simply the economics of it. It's no longer economical to mine it, move it, and burn it. To generate power. So coal has been decreasing for more than a decade in this country in its use, and has decreased across different administrations. It's not going to matter. That's the important thing is, if you look at the economics of it. But I think the other piece of it, which is really important, the military does this, is energy independence. So over the last decade, the military has been putting in solar power, putting in wind power, and building what they call microgrids, which are off the main grid. So if the main electric grid fails, military bases still have their own power and they have battery sources. And I know a whole lot of Vermonters who have solar panels, us included, many of whom have batteries. And so that alternative energy gives you an independence that you don't have when you're tied to the grid all the time.
I just brought an electric car home to my household. Mm-hmm. And I have just ordered an inverter so that I can run my house on it when the grid's down.
Yeah, great, isn't it? And
it feels like independence or safety zone.
If the Gulf blows up and oil prices triple, you're not going to care.
No.
it's a very powerful thing to have that. I mean, we just yesterday got an electric car and got rid of our gas car. And I'm like, wow, drive by a gas station. I don't have to worry about that price anymore.
Hey, you know, before we leave you, Paul, I have a question that's, you know, tinged politically, economically, and, well, geopolitical. We know the leader of the current administration has talked about Greenland quite a bit. We know we have a military presence there. We also know that the Greenland ice shelf is melting, and there's lots of talk about the shipping lanes opening up and what an economic opportunity for world powers that could be shipping through there. Is that a concern as far as, you know, at least trying to mitigate some of what's going on in there with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet?
Oh, that's a tangled problem. And I would encourage your listeners to have a read of the book.
Okay.
Because I go through the history of basically the colonial occupation of Greenland, the U.S. occupation of Greenland, why it was strategically important. And, you know, I think having that history is really critical to understand what's going on right now.
Yeah.
Greenland is an awful difficult place to work in.
Sure.
Logistically, you know, there's a few tens of thousands of people. There's a few tens of miles of paved roads. Mining is not going to be simple there. Resource extraction is not going to be simple. And so I think it's really important to kind of separate the fact from the noise on this. And there's an op-ed that I wrote last week in a place called Undark that your listeners might want to look at. And it's the short story of it is that I think Trump is right, but for the wrong reasons. He's right to think about Greenland, but the real economic value of Greenland is not the resources and not the shipping lanes. It's the ice.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we lose that ice, every major port in the United States, including those that host our naval fleets, are going to be underwater.
Uh-huh.
And that's going to cost us way more than anything we're going to get out of mineral mines in Greenland. So, you know, I wrote that piece to try to say, yeah, we got to care about Greenland, but not necessarily by putting our military in there, but by thinking about its strategic value in the longer term.
Wow. Well, we'll check that out. Undark, is that something that can be found online, Paul?
I will put it in our notes. I have it.
He's got it.
It's online and it's free.
Wow. We like it. We like it. All right. From the Gund Institute, we've been talking with Paul Bierman up there at the University of Vermont. Very, very cogent and salient remarks you've made today.
Excellent. Great. Thank you, Paul, for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Okay.
Yep. Excellent. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
All right. Wow. We pulled off the doubleheader, Henry.
That's a heavy-duty information today.
Yeah. So a lot of remarks being made by two sage speakers. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. We're a little music underneath us from the band. Do you have this album, Weather Report? Heavy Weather, Henry?
I don't have that. That sounds like a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. This is called A Remark You Made. We do have time to slide in a few little tidbits. Henry, you mentioned your EV. You brought it back. How did that work out going from Boston up to Burlington?
Well, it was. I did it at started off the second morning at 0 degrees.
Oh,
and electric
batteries don't like that. No, they don't like that too much.
Batteries tend to, you know, think. I don't know if you spend a lot of time outside with your cell phone exposed. It gets to the point where it doesn't even turn on.
Yeah, 20 to 30%. Yeah, yeah, you lose range maybe 20 to 30%. Yep.
But it's not a deal breaker.
Yep.
And I found that as the car warmed up and the battery was warm, that I was starting to get almost my regular stated mileage or even up to that.
Nice.
I recharged at Walmart, and it was an interesting trip. And I now am set up so that I basically keep it topped up when I'm at either of the houses that I spend most of my time at. And Burlington Electric gives you 7 cents off a kilowatt if you charge only at nighttime.
Gotcha.
So, I think that's a message. And as I said, mine is not set up to produce 120 volts AC. But I did this with my Prius before, which was rusting out, and I was told that I wouldn't get another year out of it, so I made the move to an EV. I put an alternator in that is on the little 12-volt battery, which doesn't amount to anything. You flatten it in a heartbeat. But if the vehicle's turned on, then you're drawing from the big battery. In the case of the hybrid, you're drawing from the gasoline tank, and it runs to keep that little battery charged and then turns off and then recharges it.
Okay.
And so that allows you to have a big power supply.
Good for you, Henry. 20 seconds to go. Let's acknowledge our underwriters here on Green Zine: Solaflect Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White River Land Collaborative, and Wit and Grit. Henry, we'll look forward to speaking with you next week here at WFVR LP South Royalton.